first thing, can you tell us your name, your position at the ECCC, and a brief summary of what you were doing there?
Yes, well, my name is Sylvia Cartwright. I'm a former judge from New Zealand. I was engaged at the ECC as a member of the five-judge trial chamber, and in that capacity, I, with my colleagues, conducted two of the trials from beginning to end. As well as that, I took a significant part in the development of the rules of procedure, and of course, the writing of the verdicts at the end of both of those trials.
What brought you to the ECCC in that role?
I had been a judge in New Zealand, but had been obliged to resign from my judicial posts prematurely, that is before the normal retirement age, because I took up another position which was incompatible with that in New Zealand. And at the end of that position, which was time limited, approximately 5.5 years, I felt that I could still make a contribution and it wasn't really useful to try and rejoin the New Zealand bench, so I looked internationally. I had other international experience, albeit on a human rights treaty body.
Great. Well, certainly had some interesting experiences. I'd love to talk a little bit more about your experience kind of in the early stages of the trial chamber. As you mentioned, you were there from the beginning. Can you tell us a little bit about your role in helping to set up the court's procedures and, you know, get the trial chamber ready for trials?
Well, the development of the rules of procedure was extremely difficult, not only because although we had a draft to work from, it was not a particularly useful draft, primarily, I suppose, because it was drafted by common lawyers who didn't have the depth of experience with the civil law procedures that the ECCC adopted and was obliged to conduct because it's based in the Cambodian courts, which uses the civil law procedure. And so that initial draft needed a great deal of review and a great deal of negotiation between the Cambodian judges, who of course were highly skilled in the Cambodian procedures, but had little international law experience. And that took a very long time. So there were two aspects to it: the actual drafting of professional procedural rules that complied with the rather unusual situation we were in, namely that this was an international criminal trial being conducted ostensibly within the court system of Cambodia, which was essentially a domestic tribunal, and also the difficulties of negotiating with judges who were totally committed to their own way of doing things, and quite properly, I'm not criticizing that, but needed to understand why their rules of procedure needed to be expanded very much to allow for the different roles, the different subjects, the different criminal processes that we were about to encounter. That took, if I recall correctly, over a year, and we had a very bad beginning because our first plenary gave us 5 days to adopt the draft rules, but by the end of that first 5 days, we'd only adopted one sub-rule, so we were a long way off completing a usable set of procedural rules. So from that point on, I came and went from New Zealand to Cambodia until we finally reached a compromised set of rules that were then adopted at the plenary of all the judges. There were some particular issues around the rules, the most notable of which was the inclusion of the rights of victims to have a role in the procedures that is common in domestic civil law trials, not in that sense, not common and common law trials. We have a different process to the civil law, but had not been contemplated at all by those who negotiated the agreement between the UN and the Royal Government of Cambodia. And so that was particularly tricky to resolve.
Yeah, I'd like to maybe touch on some more of the issues with civil parties in a bit. But first, speaking of the way the court was set up, I'd like to talk a little bit about the hybrid aspect of the court. What do you think some of the positives and negatives of that were at the ACCC?
Well, if I'm speaking personally, for me as a common law judge, it was fascinating to be part of a trial that was being conducted primarily under the civil law model, although aspects of civil law and common law have merged over the years at the international level, this was still essentially a civil law trial. And so I found this very interesting and sometimes extremely challenging to accept some of the procedures. But we weren't conducting the trials for my benefit, so looking at it more broadly, it was at first extremely difficult to find a modus operandi amongst judges from three different countries who were the sitting judges on the trial chamber, and a fourth country who was one of the reserve judges, because we had never worked together before. We spoke 1, 2, 3 different languages, and the reserve judge could speak excellent English, but was not quite so good with written English. And the French sitting judge had not really worked in English before. And so we had language difficulties, we had cultural, and we had legal procedural issues to work through before we could become a working team. I'm proud to say I believe we became a working team who understood each other very well and who worked together very constructively, because there were many occasions where if we hadn't wished to, there could have been a disaster over particular, usually interlocutory decisions or in trial decisions, not over the ultimate verdicts or sentence.
Great. Well, I'm glad you guys were able to get that team together. And I wonder if you could tell us about some of the challenges that you faced as an international judge on the trials.
In relation to working as part of the team?
Some of that, but if there's anything else that sort of springs to mind, I'd be happy to hear about that as well.
Yes, well, of course, the international judges had to set themselves up with homes and settle their family affairs and everything like that for an unknown period. So that, at a personal level, was interesting. Though everyone who comes to work in an international trial faces the same things. But that was an interesting experience for all of us. The challenges really were, to me, the greatest challenge was to get to know and understand my colleagues so that I would work constructively with them. And although often I had serious questions about the way they conducted their procedures, because it was civil law, not common law, and thought, actually, I'm in a civil law jurisdiction and that this is what I'm here to do. But frankly, I think this particular procedure is mad. No two ways about it. But so I had to sublimate that, because it's not my job to say, I think the civil law process is rather peculiar. It's my job to find a way to get around it. And of course, the civil law process is very elongated, and I found it extremely inchoate to deal with. I was astonished as a common lawyer to find that I could read anything I liked about the whole area of the Khmer Rouge. I could read books, I could watch movies, documentaries. I could visit Torsling prison, something that in a common law trial is completely unacceptable. And in fact, I didn't visit Torsling until after the trials were over, because I just couldn't bring myself to do it. But I found it extraordinary that we could do this and get all this additional information without having it tested in any way or put into a context that the defence and the prosecutors wanted it to be in. So that took a lot of challenge for me because I was the only common lawyer on the team. But I fully accepted that wasn't my job to challenge their way of doing things, but I had to adapt. Language difficulties were a problem. Not a massive problem, because at least one of the Cambodian judges was a fluent English speaker, and the French judge became very fluent in English and much better at dealing with written English as well. I had a pretty cruisy time because I didn't have to upskill myself in my French, which I'd abandoned in my first year at university. So I seriously thought when I went there, I'm going to have to revitalize my French, which would have been a major issue for me, to be quite frank. So I was very fortunate. Everyone, the common language in the end was English. But the president, who was learning English and had been learning English for quite a while, could understand a lot of conversations, but he, like me with my French, was rather shy of speaking it because colloquially he wasn't confident any more than I was colloquially confident with my French. And as for tackling Khmer at that stage, I never seriously tried. It just was beyond me to try and read the documents in Khmer. So that was a very interesting thing. But the president and I always were able to hold very constructive conversations, both in court, on the bench, and in chambers afterwards. And we usually had an interpreter with us, and we got on very well and were able to work together very constructively. At least I think we did.
Yeah, that's great.
I believe we're friends, even though we'll probably never see each other again, and even though we don't speak easily to each other without someone else there to help us. So.
Sure. Well, that's great, and I can certainly imagine how those language issues would be quite the challenge. I wonder if we might speak a little bit more about your relationships, either with the other judges or with the staff, or rather your interactions with them. Are there any anecdotes that come to mind that could help illustrate how you and the judges or you and the staff were able to work together?
Well, we were all worried at first that the need for a supermajority would create massive problems. In fact, I think I can only remember about twice where it got to a serious point of dissension, insofar as we thought, well, we won't be able to reach agreement. I'm not meaning we were angry with each other, but arguing, you know, taking a different approach legally speaking. And we managed to resolve those sometimes in quite a convoluted way. Now let me try and recall the situation. I can't remember the particular instance, but we were divided 3-2, and it was not going to be resolved because neither one of the two was prepared to join the majority to make it a supermajority, and two from the actual majority weren't prepared to join the two, so it was never going to be resolved. And in the end, we all sat down and we talked about the outcome, and we understood, and this was our clear understanding, that left us with no decision. It wasn't just a minority majority. There was no decision because you'd have to have four to have a decision and one to have a dissent. And so we looked at what that would mean. There is no decision here. And actually the outcome was not that unsatisfactory. So we just left it like that.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Can you elaborate on, just to give us an example on what the outcome would be in that situation?
It's coming back to me, but I don't really want to state it publicly because I might get it wrong, and also it could be unfair in some ways. So I'm not as clear as with the details now as I was then, but I actually thought that was a wonderful pragmatic solution to our problems.
It is very pragmatic. That's funny.
There was one occasion where I moved to join and make a super majority because I was not, I could see that we couldn't leave a decision undecided. So unlike the previous situation, this was an occasion where there had to be a decision. You couldn't say, well, we can't decide, so now what do we do? So I moved to join the majority, and that resolved that one. So those are probably the two most serious occasions.
Yeah.
Well, after doing a bit of negotiating on my part, I didn't just join with no conditions.
Yeah. No, that sounds good that you were thinking about it in those practical terms. Some of our other interviewees have talked about some of the practical issues with the court of what it was intended to be or actually went. So cool. Mm-hmm. All right. I'd like to circle back to victim participation. So you've spoken elsewhere about the role of victims in international tribunals like this one. What do you think worked well at the ECCC regarding victim participation, and what do you think could have been improved?
Well, it was such a fraught area, partly because we were not equipped to cope with the number of victims that would wish to and were equipped to have their say in the court proceedings. The court was simply not able physically, financially, or legally to cope with the numbers. If you recall, in the second trial, there were approximately 4,000 registered victims. And that, if you just think, if even half of them had chosen to come to court one day, it would have been impossible. So it wasn't just for physical reasons, because you can overcome those, but we weren't equipped legally because we couldn't provide them, they could not be provided with adequate legal representation to have their voices heard individually. It just couldn't be done. And we had started from a rather unfortunate foundation insofar as it had never been contemplated that victims would be represented in the way that they are in traditional domestic civil law trials. And so the UN and the royal government had not contemplated this in their negotiations. And so we had to create all of these mechanisms, the judges had to do that, in order to give effect to what we had agreed to in the rules of procedure. I look back now, and at the time I thought, this sounds like an excellent idea to me. I'm a great proponent of having victims' voices heard clearly in trials, but I wasn't thinking it through. And some of the civil law judges who fully understood what it meant were vehemently opposed to including victims in the trials in the way that they are in domestic civil law trials. I should have listened to them. However, when I look back, we would have been in even more trouble because the victims would not have liked that at all. But so you can see we were caught in a whirlpool of difficulties. It was resolved, you may recall, between the first and second trials by grouping the victims together and giving them common co-lawyers who would represent their voices in court, allowing their individual lawyers to make submissions from time to time, and so on. Even so, it was clumsy, it was not terribly effectual, but it was probably better than nothing. I find it unfortunate that we faced so much criticism over this aspect, because I don't know who would have found a way to resolve the problem. And then more philosophically, it did disturb me that even though there was something like 4,000 victims registered for the second trial, they represented a tiny fraction of the victims of the whole regime. And indeed, they probably comprised the ones who were emotionally, physically, and financially able to participate. In other words, the victims who had the greatest difficulties were not really seen or heard at the trials. And so that disturbed me as well. We were only seeing this tiny fraction and a very unrepresentative fraction of victims. So it, as you can see, it was a massive problem, and I still don't know how we could have resolved it in any better way.
Got it. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the role of women in these trials. So you were actually the first woman to be appointed to New Zealand's High Court. You were also a member of the United Nations Convention to Eliminate All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. So you have some experience of women in difficult situations, I'm guessing. Do you feel that women faced unique challenges during the trials, either because of the trials themselves or because of actions committed against them during the Khmer Rouge era?
I presume you're talking about the victims rather than the judges.
Sorry, yes, the victims. Although, I mean, if you faced issues as a woman judge, happy to hear about those too.
No, I did not face any issues as a woman judge in the ECCC, so you can put that to one side. And I, because of my age, my status, my hair colour, I was given the utmost respect by all the Cambodian judges and quite a few of the international judges.
Okay.
But when it comes to the victims, I was, again, very surprised that we did not see or hear any evidence very little evidence of any sexual crimes against women during the Khmer Rouge era, because it's well known that you hardly even need research on the topic, that sexual violence will form a massive part of any conflict. And I couldn't understand it for a long time. It was outside my control because I had to deal with the indictment as it stood, or the closing order as it stood. But when I thought about it, I thought there were probably two reasons for this, or three reasons. First of all, the usual one, that women who've been traumatized in this way are much less likely to come to court than people who have suffered other forms of traumatization. Second reason is that it seems to me that the Khmer Rouge were a very puritanical group, and they had quite a lot of discipline against their cadre for all sorts of misbehavior, probably including sexual misbehavior or sexual crimes. I don't want to minimize what happened, because I'm certain it happened and probably very widespread. Thirdly, this goes to a feminist perspective, I don't believe the prosecutors or the investigators really looked for it. Those are my reasons. They have been very cross with me for saying that, but that's how I feel.
That's interesting. I wonder if you could tell us on that side, on the investigation side particularly, if what could have been done perhaps to unearth some of these crimes during the investigative phase?
Well, it would have taken a lot more time to investigate the crimes, because the investigators were looking for overt criminal acts such as in work camps, enslavement, imprisonment, and so on, and, you know, traditional criminal acts in the international criminal law sphere. So they would have needed to have had specialized investigators who were fully familiar with this type of investigation, who knew where to look for it, how to talk to people, how to record it, and that would have meant Khmer speaking investigators. So I think it would have been, again, an almost impossible task. And so I really need to say that my criticism of the investigators for not really looking at it, maybe because they simply didn't have the time, the skills, or the knowledge to do so.
Sure. Okay. Are there any lessons learned or best practices that you experienced during the trials that might give you recommendations for future courts handling mass atrocities based on the atrocity?
Well, there's some macro ones, such as secure funding would be good. Second issue, the UN is not good at administration, and that goes for everything from the in-court administration, I'm not talking about the greffiers, I'm talking about the basic infrastructure, right through to simple things like just hiring legal officers. It would be lovely to get one when they've had 6 months' notice that someone's leaving. It'd be really good to have someone in place. The hiring practices are absolutely outdated and incredibly destructive of the work of a court, which can't stop while you wait for a judge or some other person to join the team who's vital to it. Mm-hmm. There are some extraordinary stories about hiring practices, including one relating to me personally, where I had come back to New Zealand. I can't remember for what purpose, but I'd come back to New Zealand for something like 2 weeks and returned to Cambodia to be greeted with by the administration, not by my colleagues, by the administration with some surprise because for some reason they thought I had resigned, which I had not done. In the meantime, they had contacted a New Zealand Queen's Council who'd expressed a very vague interest in doing something like this sometime in the future and had talked to me and one of the New Zealand legal officers, but had not progressed it beyond that. Absolutely no way he could leave his practice, his family, anything at that stage. It was just a vaguely expressed interest. No formal applications, nothing. They had contacted him and asked him, without explaining, to undergo some chest x-rays, which he did at his own expense. And then he heard nothing more. And one day he rang me and said, "Do you know what that was all about?" And I had found out in the meantime that they'd been earmarking him to replace me, although I hadn't resigned, and it was in the middle of a trial anyway. He was totally surprised, as was I, by this this instance. In fact, it's probably the only time I've ever seen the UN move quite quickly, albeit erroneously.
Yeah. I'm so sorry you had to deal with that. Those are definitely good stories for us to hear. Any accused or survivor stories you've heard that particularly resonated with you at the agency?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, the thing is with judges, people ask you, how do you cope with the stories? But I try to describe it by saying that it's a bit like running a film through your head. You're watching and listening, but you're also trying to apply this material to the job in front of you, which is, how does this fit into the closing order? How does this fit into the charges that they're facing? What will I be saying about this particular matter in the verdict? So it doesn't have the emotional impact on you that it might have with someone who's not a judge, not a lawyer, who is accustomed to processing the information in a certain way as you're listening to it or watching it or whatever. Probably my most, I have given quite a few speeches in my lifetime, but a few speeches relating to international criminal law and particularly victim participation. And so I selected a few victim experiences so that I could tell an audience that wasn't necessarily au fait with, well, wouldn't be au fait with these trials, just what these people went through, and used their own words. And the one that really still I can remember every detail of is the little boy with his little brother who landed up in Tuol Sleng about 2 days or a few days before it was liberated or invaded, whichever you prefer, by the Vietnamese. And his experiences of trying to find his mother, hiding the other children in a pile of clothing, thinking that a baby, a breastfed baby, had gone to sleep when he was trying to find feed it rice gruel. In fact, it had just died in his arms. And running around the prison looking for his mother and seeing recently slaughtered prisoners with machete wounds. That one was very hard. And it still is.
Yeah, we're ending the end of our interviews, and that's probably one of the worst ones that I've heard. So thank you for sharing with us.
He was only 8, I think, at the time, and he thought he was having a nightmare.
Okay. So one more question.
I was cheered up by the fact that when he came to give evidence, he said that he was very proud. He was the best bulldozer driver in Buttonwong.
That's really nice. No, I'm good. It's always nice to hear when people are able to kind of move past these things too. I can't imagine doing it myself. Okay, so last question on our end. What do you think the major impacts of the ECCC will be for Cambodia, both today and perhaps 20 years from now?
I think they have very little impact currently. I think that the notion of working with experienced international judges is a good one, provided you've got the right sorts of international judges, and we're not all perfect or ideally suited to this work by any means. But I think in the current political environment in Cambodia, the seeds that have been sown and which were willingly being watered by my Cambodian colleagues, or some of them, and by the legal officers, some of them, are going to take a long time to cultivate, because there is no way currently, from my distance and in my reading of the political situation, that proper trials, proper use of pretrial detention, appropriate sentences, and all those absolute basic facets of the criminal trial within the whole system of the rule of law will be properly observed. Not for a long time.
All right. Thank you for that. Before we wrap up, is there anything we haven't talked about that you think is important or you'd like to say?
No, there's nothing else. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you again for speaking with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Nicole. And my best wishes to the director.